of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. United States is calling for a vote Friday on a newly revised and tougher UN resolution declaring that an immediate sustained ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war is imperative to protect civilians and enable humanitarian aid to be delivered to more than 2 million hungry Palestinians. In the previous draft, the Security Council did not make such a declaration. Meanwhile, at a news conference, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. remains against Israel's plan for a ground offensive against Hamas and Rafah.
Military operation in Rafah would be a mistake, something we don't support, and it's also not necessary to deal with Hamas, which is necessary. We're going to have an opportunity next week to share in detail that view with our Israeli counterparts.
AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports that House Speaker Mike Johnson says he'll love to have Israel's prime minister address Congress amid growing criticism from Democrats.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says he plans to invite Israel's prime minister to address Congress. It would be a GOP show of support amid growing criticism from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and other Democrats of Benjamin Netanyahu's leadership.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way.
Republicans have rallied around Netanyahu since. Johnson tells CNBC he'll invite Netanyahu to address Congress. Such a speech during the Hamas war would be seen as highly politicized by many Democrats critical of Netanyahu's war tactics. Schumer says he would welcome an address. Sagar Magani, Washington.
You'll find more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Four Central European countries remain deeply divided over how to resolve Russia's war against Ukraine. Their foreign ministers said Thursday. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has details.
Foreign ministers from the Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, and Slovakia met Thursday to discuss a Czech plan to acquire ammunition that Ukraine badly needs from third countries outside the European Union. But the foreign ministers of Hungary and Slovakia said they are not ready to change the refusal to provide arms to Ukraine. This is Juraj Blanár, Slovak Minister of Foreign Affairs.
We have to fight for our national interest. As you might know, that Slovakia is very dependent on gas and nuclear fuel from the Russia.
Under the plan, the Czechs seek to obtain 800,000 artillery shells for Ukraine. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Lawmakers introduced a $1.2 trillion spending package Thursday that sets the stage for avoiding a partial government shutdown for several key federal agencies in the U.S. this weekend, and it allows Congress nearly 6 months into the budget year to complete its work for funding the government through September. Democrats were able to swat back scores of policy mandates and some of the steeper budget cuts that House Republicans were seeking. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports on a Trump fundraising appeal that focuses mainly on the former president's legal bills.
Donald Trump's new joint fundraising agreement with the Republican National Committee directs donations to his campaign and a political action committee that pays his legal bills before the RA gets a cut. And makes it more likely that Republican donors could see their money go to Trump years. They've already received at least $76 million over the last 2 years to defend him against four felony indictments and multiple civil cases. Trump has invited high-dollar donors to Palm Beach, Florida for an April 6 fundraiser. I'm Norman Hall.
A federal judge has given prison terms of about 10 to 40 years to six white former Mississippi law enforcement officers who pleaded guilty to breaking into a home without a warrant and torturing two black men. The judge gave sentences near the top of federal guidelines to five of the six culprits. He sentenced the final two on Thursday. The six officers were fired and pleaded guilty to brutalizing Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker in January of last year. The so-called goon squad broke into a home where a neighbor complained that the black men were staying with a white woman. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barkley in Washington. Today is Friday, March 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A spokesperson says Senegal's main opposition candidate, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, will win Sunday's vote in the first round as campaigning concludes today, Friday.
We are ready and everything has been done in our side. We are confident that it will be one round and our candidate, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, will be elected not less than 60%.
Kenyans debate whether their government should deploy police to Haiti amid gang violence there. A nationwide public doctor's strike in Kenya for better pay enters its seventh day yesterday, Thursday. Today, March 22nd, is the World Water Day.
As the United Nations marks World Water Day on Friday, it's estimated that 2.2 billion people live without safely managed drinking water.
And wildlife conservation and traditional medicine collide in Eswatini. Those stories from Samson O'Malley's Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesperson says Senegal's main opposition presidential candidate, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, will win Sunday's vote in the first round as campaigning concludes today, Friday. El Hadj Malik Ndiaye says the margin will be as high as 60%. Diomaye Faye represents main opposition leader Ousmane Sonko's Pastef party. Both men were released from incarceration about a week ago. There are 17 other presidential candidates, including the ruling party. Diomaye Faye's spokesperson, Malik Ndiaye, tells me that Senegalese voters are yearning for change and that they believe Pastef is the party that will deliver the goods.
As you may know, the Senegalese people are aspiring to change the system we used to have since our independence. And for sure, it's our political party or our project who is presenting the total change that we need in order to be in a new path for our country, economically, politically, socially, and all of this. What we are proposing is really what the Senegalese people and globally African people are aspiring to. We have a young candidate, well motivated, very professional. He is supported by the one famous political leader, President Ousmane Sonko. So if we combine the two, for sure we will be, of course, the favorite for this election. And currently what we see is one round election.
Your candidate, Mr. Farr, has said that one of his priorities, if he's elected president, will be to restore the rule of law. What do you think he means?
Because as you've noticed that in the very three past years, the law in Senegal has been really used for political objectives. And it should not be like that. So that's why for us it's vital to make sure that justice will be really well reviewed and make sure that all people will be equal in terms of justice, and also make sure that the professional of the justice, the magistrate and all of them will be protected to do their job correctly without satisfying political objectives. And also we have been a victim of injustice. Our candidate, our leader, more than 1.5 thousand Senegalese people in jail. And all this come from justice. So meaning we need, of course, to take it as a priority to review the institution in this country, to make them stronger. As said by Obama in the past, Africa don't need strong leaders, but strong institutions. And that's the case for us.
Mr. Faye and Mr. Sonko were released recently from incarceration. Do you think you had enough time to campaign?
Really, we didn't even need to have them in the campaign. Because Senegalese people have already made their choice and everything is for them. They know why they were put in jail. Just because they were doing everything to fight against our project. But strategically, President Ousmane Sonko, who is a very big and generous leader, has thinking all about this and prepared several scenarios. That's why we have a good candidate, the best one. Now, having President Ousmane Sonko and Bassirou Diomaye Faye released a week before is just fantastic. And you can see it in the pictures everywhere they go. you see that the Senegalese people are really willing to elect the candidate of our project. And the project is Senegalese, where we have justice, and Senegal, which is well developing.
Once again, is your party ready for Sunday's vote? And do you think it will be free and fair?
Yes, we are ready, and everything has been done in our side. So just waiting for Sunday. And for sure, we are confident that it will be one round, and our candidate, Basir Jamai Faye, will be elected, not less than 60% for us. Our main obligation is just to make sure that the vote is secured.
El Hadj Malik Ndiaye is the spokesperson for Senegal opposition presidential candidate Basir Diomaye Faye, representing Ousmane Sonko's Pastef party. Algeria will hold early presidential elections in September, 3 months ahead of schedule, a statement from the president's office said, without providing further details. Abdelmadji Tebboune, who turned 79 in November, was elected in December 2019 after pro-democracy protests that broke out in February that year forced longtime president Abdelaziz Bouteflika to flee. According to the French news agency, the AFP, Tebboune has not said if he will seek a second term in office, and there was no immediate explanation on why an early presidential election has been called. There is growing risk of conflict over water resources as climate change takes hold, according to the United Nations, which is marking World Water Day today, Friday. Meanwhile, the aid agency Oxfam accused the global corporations of grabbing water from poorer countries to boost profits. Henry Ritual reports from London.
In Johannesburg, South Africa, the taps are running dry. The city has seen a collapse of its water system affecting millions of people. In Soweto, on the outskirts of the city, thousands line up to collect water from tankers every day.
It has been a serious challenge, a very challenging time for my age, that I have to be here carrying these 20-litre buckets. And the sad thing is that we don't know when our tap's going to be wet again.
Crumbling infrastructure is hardly to blame, but scientists say climate change is causing rivers and reservoirs to dry up in South Africa and many other parts of the world. As the United Nations marks World Water Day on Friday, it's estimated that 2.2 billion people live without safely managed drinking water. UN scientists say roughly half of the world's population is experiencing severe water scarcity for at least part of the year, with poorer nations in the global south or developing countries the most affected. In a new report, the aid agency Oxfam accuses major global corporations of grabbing and polluting vital water resources at the expense of local populations in order to make profits.
Water is overused by northern countries and is depriving southern countries from access to water.
Oxfam accuses richer countries and multinationals of shifting water pressure to poorer regions by extracting water from natural sources for industrial or agricultural use and through the import of water-intensive products like fruit, vegetables, meat, flowers, and bottled water. The report says agriculture accounts for 70% of water withdrawals, including through irrigation systems to support the meat industry and biofuels. But Oxfam's analysis suggests the private sector is failing to reduce its impact on water resources.
350 corporations that have been analyzed through that database, which counts for like half of the world agricultural revenue, only one of the four of them are declaring they are reducing water use and pollution.
The UN is warning this year of the growing risk of conflict over water. It says that as nations manage climate change, mass migration and political unrest, they must put water cooperation at the heart of their plans. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
UK You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Martin, Washington. Today is Friday, March 22nd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Kenyan doctors stopped providing emergency services at public hospitals yesterday, Thursday, as they entered the seventh day of a nationwide strike. The Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union accuses the government of failing to implement a raft of promises made in the collective bargaining agreement signed in 2017. The doctors are on strike over poor pay and working conditions, despite a court order calling for talks between the doctors and the health ministry. Political analyst David Monda tells BBC's Douglas Mpuga he thinks the government is not doing enough to solve the problem.
I don't think the government, in my view, is doing enough to solve the problem, because these are doctors' grievances that have been going on for a long time. The government has constantly been saying about the remuneration of the doctors, it's going to fix that, about the working conditions of the doctors, it's going to fix that, about recruitment of new doctors who are qualifying from our universities and colleges, that they're going to fix that, and that has still not been done. And let's also not forget that we have this very controversial hiring of Cuban doctors, yet Kenyan doctors were not getting jobs. So it's all a big mess, to be very honest.
And why do you think the government is slow walking the process of negotiation with the doctors?
I think the government, unfortunately, has not really seriously taken the demands of the doctors seriously. I think this has always been played as a political question, where we had the governor of Nairobi recently saying that unless the doctors in Nairobi went back to work immediately, that they would be fired. You know, the doctors will say, then go ahead and fire us, because they know there's nobody who can take over their jobs. So the government has had a very heavy-handed kind of approach, both at the county level, but also at the national level of government. But I think more importantly, it's the broader question about how we recruit, how we compensate, and how we retain our doctors. I think this is something the government really needs to take seriously. Otherwise, a lot of these doctors, quite honestly, are going to emigrate abroad, where they can get better paid, better work conditions, and a better work environment.
What do you make of the plight of the people, given that many Kenyans can't afford private medical care from private institutions?
Yes, this is the unfortunate part, because you find out that the person who suffers the most is, you know, the poorest of the poor, people who cannot afford medicine, people who cannot afford to pay when they go to hospital. These are the people that are suffering right now. So I really think it's a question that the government really needs to step in with urgency, because ultimately it's the weakest of the weak and the poorest of the poor who continue to suffer from this doctor strike. But I think also in terms of the doctors, there really needs to be an outreach to the government to try and get some kind of negotiated stance, because it's also not good for the doctor's profession to be seeing the public suffering in this way, and for doctors not to be reporting for duty to save lives, because people are dying every day we have this strike going on.
That's David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with viewers Douglas Mpuga. While some Kenyans support President William Ruto's insistence on sending a police mission to Haiti, many others still wonder why their country wants to lead a multinational force aimed at helping quell violence and restore security, given that other nations that are more powerful and better equipped have not stepped in. Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo reports.
Passions are running high in the streets of Nairobi over possibly deploying the country's police to Haiti.
Now, why are you sending police instead of sending military for such thing? That's my question.
It does nothing, because we want to lose our beloved ones. Kenya, we don't have that power like the other countries, like the United States.
I think that's a noble idea, because we are human beings. Although people are complaining about the procedure which has been used,
we should urge the government of the day to at least follow the court orders.
President William Ruto, who recently signed a long-awaited bilateral accord with visiting Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry to pave the way for 1,000 Kenyan police officers to lead a proposed multinational UN-backed force that would help restore security in Haiti, insists it's the right thing to do.
It is a mission for humanity. It is a mission in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Haiti.
However, signing that accord was immediately followed by a fierce battle between Haitian police and armed gangs who blocked Henry's return to the Caribbean nation and eventually pushed the prime minister to say he will resign as soon as a transitional council is put in place. Attorney Ekuru Aukot was among a group that filed a petition before Kenya's high court that argued sending the country's police to Haiti was unconstitutional. He says the recent signing was misleading.
First of all, it's a bogus agreement because it has no legitimacy, both in law and even on the person representing. Ariel Henry, for you to be able to enter into a contract, you must have capacity to enter into a contract.
And there are still problems whether this mission will go on or not, because all the legal benchmarks have still not been satisfied, he says.
When Jovenel Moïse was killed in July 2021, Ariel Henry was only supposed to be in power for 120 days. For him to take over the role of a prime minister under the constitution of Haiti, he must be ratified, vetted by parliament, and approved by parliament. He was never. So really the question then, coming to the agreement, who is this who actually signed this agreement with the Republic of Kenya?
With such a hostile and volatile situation now in Haiti, Musamawi says it's hard to envision that a military or a police intervention would work. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Traditional medicine, or muti, is an important part of Eswatini's culture. However, an increase in demand for muti has placed some of the Southern African kingdom's animal species at risk of extinction. As Nokukanya Muse reports, conservationists and molecular biologists are working hard to protect the animals from poachers who sell animal parts to local dehulers.
Young molecular biologist Zamegile Bembe, who works for the USAID-funded eWild Laboratory at the University of Eswatini, is fighting poachers and trying to get them convicted for their crimes. She says poaching for traditional medicinal purposes is a leading cause of biodiversity decline and calls for stronger regulations to protect wildlife.
Every time you see decline in biodiversity, there'll be some sort of poaching that is involved there. As the country, we also cannot deny the fact that we are using these resources as our traditional medicine. It's just that we need a way of regulating.
For generations, the people of Eswatini have held traditional beliefs and values close to their hearts. This is reflected in the fact that over 80% of the population still consults traditional healers or witch doctors for advice and healing. These healers use a wide range of plant and animal species to create traditional medicine, drawing on knowledge passed down through generations. However, excessive hunting has endangered the local populations of pangolins, crocodiles, vultures, and owls, leading to calls for more sustainable practices. Makanya Makanya is president of the Witch Doctors Association and a wildly renowned traditional healing practitioner in his own right. Makanya says the role of traditional healers needs to be protected. He says we have served our nation for generations, providing healing and support to those in need. However, the current laws do not reflect the reality of our work. We need regulations that recognize our role in society and that allow us to continue serving our people. Patrick Maduna is a South African citizen who travels from neighboring South Africa to Eswatini to seek traditional medicinal solutions. His preference for traditional healing shows the complex relationship between modern and traditional medicine in Eswatini.
I came all the way to Swaziland for a traditional attention. I have been using the same traditional doctor since 2006. I've been coming to the same place. So for me to come and get traditional attention, it's, to me, it's more like therapy. I've never ever gone to the hospital.
Maduna says if there are laws in Eswatini to limit the poaching of animals for traditional medicine, he believes the so-called witch doctors would comply with the rules. Nogukanya Musi, VOA News, Manzini, Eswatini.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the Paris Olympics. The official draw of the men's football competition at this year's Paris 2024 Olympics has been conducted. Reigning champions of the CAF Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations, Morocco, have been placed in an interesting group consisting of South American powerhouse Argentina, Ukraine, as well as an Asian nation that will finish third at the Asian Cup. The African champions kick off their campaign against Argentina before facing the Asian representatives before concluding their Group B assignment against Ukraine. Runners-up at the CAF Under-23 AFCON, Egypt, are drawn in Group C, where they will face Spain, Dominican Republic, as well as the runners-up of the Asian Cup. Bronze medalist Mali are in Group D that consists of the Asian Cup champions, Paraguay, as well as Israel. They could potentially be a third African representatives at the Paris showpiece. Guinea, who finished fourth at the CAF AFCON, have an outside chance of being the fourth African representatives, provided they overcome the fourth place finishers at the Asian Cup. In netball news, the baby Proteas of South Africa have qualified for the 2025 Netball World Cup, set to take place in Gibraltar. The baby Proteas of South Africa secured their final spot in the Netball World Youth Cup 2025 Africa Regional Qualifiers on Thursday with an emphatic 61-25 victory over Namibia. Coach Precious Mthembu led her team to 6 matches unbeaten in the competition.
I'm very excited that the baby Proteas have qualified for the Junior World Cup in 2025. So I think the junior started right now, and hopefully on Saturday the girls will do their best by getting the gold.
In the second match of the day, Malawi beat Zambia 54-35. The final match saw Namibia, who earlier lost against South Africa, secure a thrilling last second 44-44 draw against Kenya after trailing for the better part of the game. In Friday's fixtures, Namibia will face Zambia, Kenya will play Tanzania, while Malawi will square up against Zimbabwe. In cricket news, Nigeria's senior women's cricket team have moved one place up at the International Cricket Council ICC T20 rankings. The rankings released on the ICC website sees Nigeria leap to 26th from 27th, the position they were heading to the 13th Africa Games in Ghana. Nigeria was the least ranked team among 7 other countries that include Zimbabwe, South Africa, Rwanda, Kenya, Namibia, Uganda and Tanzania, who featured in the women's event. And finally, in the African Games, Tunisian player Moise Echeragui was crowned winner in the tennis event of the Africa Games in Accra, Ghana, after defeating Zimbabwe's Benjamin Locke in the finals by 2-1 on Thursday. By winning gold at the Africa Games, Echeragui secured his qualification for the Paris 2024 Olympic Games. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, March 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa next team, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.
It is said
that most firstborn daughters face pressures and often seen as the third parent to their young siblings. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we hear testimonies as well as experts' take on how firstborn daughters handle the responsibilities of being a caretaker and a house helper in a family, even from a very young age. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 19.